Danger. The emergency disrupt system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanny Show, Crimson Peak Edition!
Reviving the gothic romance, could we be more quixotic?
I'm not Sean.
I'm not Paul.
And I'm not anyone you've heard on the podcast before.
Hi everybody, you may have noticed this is a slightly irregular show because poor Sean, our fearless leader, kind of hates his life right now because he's a graduate student. Feel pain in your heart for him. I am actually Rachel Axe, who you've obviously heard before.
And I'm David Annandale, also heard from before.
And I'm Trish E. Mattson. I've been lurking silently listening to the podcasts, but I'm also the co-editor of the Skiffy and Fanty blog.
And this is her first show recorded with us. Yay!
Yay!
And yes, as I said before, today we're going to talk about Crimson Peak, which is Guillermo del Toro's new movie that got completely fucked over by its terrible ad campaign, and you should go watch it right now. And I do believe David got voluntold that he was going to give us the summary.
So, briefly, aspiring writer of apparently gothic romances, Edith Cushing, played by Mia Wasikowska, marries the dashing yet slightly strange Thomas Sharp, played by Tom Hiddleston, and heads off with his even more strange sister, Lucille, played by Jessica Chastain, to Allerdale Hall in England, where all sorts of spooky stuff then ensues. In a nutshell.
Yeah, and it just gets spookier from there. I think for now we're going to try to keep it like mostly not spoilery, and then at some point we're going to throw down the spoiler wall because there is some shit we need to talk about.
Yeah.
True.
So, I part of the reason I was agitating for this particular podcast, other than the fact that I watched this movie and then I went and watched again and I thought it was completely amazing, is that I desperately wanted to hear what David, our resident horror wonk, had to say about it. When you see the advertising campaign for it, it's very much like, ooh, ghosts, it's spooky, it's a horror movie, and it's not really horror as modern audiences are used to seeing it. So, David, do you have thoughts about this horror thing?
Well, I would say that it is horror, but in its in a very old form. The gothic novel was the first form of the horror novel. It's changed a lot since then, of course, and so it's still in that form, but. I think I agree with you completely that the advertising campaign got bobbled badly. But I'm also not quite sure what they could have done. Because when was the last time a gothic romance was on the screen? How are they going to bring that audience in? I think this is something that was going to be niche from the very beginning. And so it may have been a financially a doomed project from the start. But it is, and it is very much, I think, a gothic in less in the sense of Jane Eyre, though it has that strong romance element. But it feels like to me a strange fusion of the Anne Radcliffe school of gothic with the strong romance element, with the Matthew Lewis school with all the very violent and explicit grotesqueries. And those are two forms that are normally incompatible. So it certainly makes for an interesting experience to see them together on the screen.
All right. And Trish, do you have any thoughts about this as far as the movie genre?
I, of course, also agree that the marketing didn't do much to draw people in. It seemed mainly aimed at jump scares. Although there are a few scary bits, and a few even startling scary bits, it's much more of a brooding atmosphere most of the time. And I'm not sure how you do a trailer for brooding intensity.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'd have to just look at the last time Jane Eyre was on. Because there's been like a feature film done of Jane Eyre, right?
There has been one. Actually, there was one fairly recently. And also, I mean, interestingly enough, Wasikowska, wasn't she in Wuthering Heights?
She was, yes.
So, you know, we have her. You know, she's got sort of a gothic pedigree there. And there was a Jane Eyre recently, but it's not an easy fit with that particular strand of gothic because of the overt supernatural. And I think that's also, I mean, that'll be something to talk about is to what degree it's successful or not in its deployment of the supernatural. But in Jane Eyre, we don't have that. In Wuthering Heights, there's a touch of the supernatural, but this is big and in your face. And, you know, I've been racking my brains trying to think of another movie like this ever, not just recently. I mean, there are plenty of gothics, but either we have the, you know, Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights, Rebecca strand, that with perhaps a greater emphasis on the romance, or certainly where the supernatural isn't playing any part, or at best a faint whisper. Or we have we get a ton of gothics in, say, in the 1960s, primarily coming out of Italy, half of them starring Barbara Steele. And, but there, the emphasis is either on there's a strong element of the supernatural, or if there isn't, it's the romance is a very minor element. So it's all necrophilia and revenge and, all kinds of luridness, and so getting them, both strands together in this film, I'll probably think of an example of 3 in the morning and feel very silly for having said this, but I can't, for the life of me, right now, think of a movie that has ever done both so fully like that, which I think raises all kinds of, I can imagine the publicity people sitting down looking at this and going, oh man, we're screwed.
Well, yeah, and I imagine, you know, probably the reason they went more for kind of like the horror and jump scare aspect is because they were hoping to get more male viewers, because everyone knows that if a guy goes and watches a romance movie and doesn't have his girlfriend with him for cover, his dick will fall off. So I think that's part of the problem. But yeah, I mean, I think Del Toro did something quite unique with this movie. And unfortunately, because it doesn't slot neatly into a particular genre, you're going to have the audience... a lot of audiences going in and feeling disappointed because it doesn't deliver exactly what they expected. I mean, you know, I saw a lot of people that kind of came out of it and they were, you know, varying from like disappointed to downright furious that the ghost didn't do anything. And yet, you know, Sunil, I love you, but you're wrong.
I wonder what would have happened if it had been marketed more with the romance angle and let's say going after that audience. I imagine they would have been, you know, rather put off by the bloody violence that we get in the film,
violence and one of the romance strands that we're not going to talk about yet.
Yeah, exactly.
We haven't put up the spoiler wall.
I did see one trailer later on that did hit the romance angle more, and it actually had a shot of Tom Hiddleston in bed with Mia. But most of the earlier stuff was just scary, spooky stuff. But I did see one trailer that emphasized the romance a little more.
Yeah, and I feel like Del Toro, once the audience is in the movie, he does this really amazing job in just the first, like, 10 to 15 minutes of setting up so much of the meta-narrative that goes, just the entire idea that if you pay attention to the book, that, you know, Crimson Peak, it is by Edith, that is kind of like the framing of the movie. And then she's talking about this novel she's writing, and she's, you know, oh, it's a ghost story. Well, the ghosts are a metaphor for the past. Well, it needs a romance. All right, well, you know, I'll put in a couple chapters of romance.
Yeah, and it's like she's, since she's reworking it, it's as if the book is being written along with the film.
Yes.
And in fact, isn't she, in the end, the book that she writes is titled Crimson Peak, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That is the I didn't notice that the first time I watched the movie, actually. And part of that is just because, you know, I had to exit the theater as soon as the credits started rolling because there was an imminent bladder explosion. But yeah, if you stay all the way to the end of the pretty sequence of credits before the regular credits roll, you see the book shut and it's Crimson Peak by Edith Cushing.
Right.
Which is, I mean, you know, that puts this whole layer of meta on it where it's kind of like, well, how much of this is the real, you know, how much of this is actually Edith's experience as opposed to this thing that she is writing and you know, coming up with her ghost story where the ghosts are just a metaphor, which is why they don't do anything because they're metaphor, I guess.
Although I think it's not quite fair to say that. They do give warnings and that's significant.
Yeah, they're way too solid to be purely metaphorical. I mean, I guess, at some point, I think, I guess there's a few things I'm thinking about there that we'll say for after the spoiler wall. But they're so, at least I think for me, this is one of the issues I had prior to the film. I was worried about the trailers made me worried about what looked like a bunch of CGI ghosties. And that concern never really went away. And even though I've seen Del Toro saying that, in fact, they were primarily practical effects enhanced by CGI, is kind of like, well, all right, you successfully made them look like CGI, which I don't think was really what you wanted.
Which made me sad.
Yeah, and I think on the one hand, they feel very, very special effecty, and on the other hand, they are so in your face that you don't really have the ambiguity that would be necessary to turn them into potentially metaphors. Like, I was never given the opportunity to doubt their existence.
I agree with that. I was going to say something along those lines, that their very vividness in several different ways made them kind of distracting. I would have preferred for the ghosts to be a little more subtle, and, as you say, for there to be some ambiguity. Is she really seeing what she thinks she sees? And these were, you know, solid-looking enough that I expected them to be able to grab people and do things, which may have been, you know, why make them that solid looking if they aren't going to do anything? So yeah, I would have preferred some more wispy transparency, I believe. Mm.
So it's kind of this, you feel like you didn't quite get the balance between where either they needed to be more real or less real.
Yeah, something like that.
In fact, for me, in some ways, a bit of both. Oh, sorry, go on, Trish.
Just that the red ghosts looked almost skinned to me, and that didn't really make any sense plot-wise to me. I mean, I guess red for violence, but it just looked like they had all been not only drenched in blood, but actually skinned. for what the rest of the movie was trying to do, it seemed just unbalanced.
It's strange. The things that, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I think we'll get into that I really, really liked about the film, but the ghosts were kind of a sticking mm-hmm. point for me, and I wanted them to be, in some ways, both more and less real than they were. I have no problem accepting them as being just genuine. And in fact, the idea that they weren't didn't really occur to me until, you were just mentioning the two of you were talking about them as metaphor. We have that moment when Edith turns away from one of the cisterns or something, and we have that skeleton, that red skeleton that rises. And this is happening when mm-hmm. she's not even looking, right? So, that's ostensibly an objective ghost that's just showing up there. And I think there's a couple of other moments where something goes by that we see and she doesn't. And I was thinking about the way ghosts, like really successful ghosts, at least, for me, have appeared in film. And the scariest ones, I think, have tended to be not particularly wispy. I mean, these look too much like ghosts in the sense of, kind of Disney's haunted palace or haunted mansion ghosts, right? With the skeleton heads and the long trailing fingers. I mean, the best moment for me is when Edith has that dream, and we get a distant shot of an extreme long shot of the ghost pointing in one direction. We can't see it too clearly.
Mm.
But if you think of the ghosts in, say, The Innocents, where they are ambiguously real, but they are just presented to us as people, but we see them in contexts where we don't want people to be, and that makes them really disturbing, as opposed to the funhouse specters that that we had here.
Okay. But so that was the major sticking point for you. I mean, before we throw up the spoiler wall, because I think at this point we really need to.
Well, let's talk about some of the fun stuff to balance.
Okay, yeah.
Gripes.
Well, that's what I was gonna say. I mean, is there any fun stuff that we can talk about before we get to like really into the meat that's gonna require spoilers? Or you know, at this point, I'd just be like, hey, everyone, go watch the movie because despite us bitching about the ghosts, it's really, really good.
Well, I think the first obvious like is the superb cast and the acting performances that they put forth. There was never a moment when I was thinking this guy is Loki instead of this guy is Thomas Sharpe. And you know, Edith was just pure, and they were just all, you know, really convincing as people, as characters. And I thought they did fantastic job of letting the play of their faces indicate some of what they were thinking, as well as delivering their dialogue perfectly.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Hiddleston could basically, you know, as I said in my giant blog post that ate an entire day, Tom Hiddleston could go play, could be Shub Nigger off the Black Goat of the Woods with 1,000 Young in an H.P. Lovecraft movie, and I'd come out of it sympathizing with Shub. That man could make anything sympathetic, because all he has to do is give you, like, the puppy dog eyes, and you're like, oh no, I feel his pain. I feel like everyone did a really great job, and I mean, Mia Wasikowska just she sold Edith to me, and was kind of a twist on what you would expect of I'd say a gothic romance heroine. That my reasoning for that is something that will have to come up later when we start talking spoilers. But I felt like actually the real standout performance for this whole thing, because at this point I'm like, yeah, Tom Hiddleston pulled on my heartstrings. What else is new? Was Jessica Chastain.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Holy crap. And she said in an interview, in the entire length of the movie, she only blinks 3 times. And it's no shit. She only blinks 3 times. It's really creepy.
Yeah, I can't say I noticed that specifically, but I did notice how intense her eyes were and how she was always, always, always watching. Watching her brother, watching Edith, watching everything.
Yeah, she was, I think... Like, for me, she was the best thing about the film. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I liked about the film, but she was astonishing. Just stole the movie in many ways.
Well, and apparently, original, she was actually offered the role of Edith. And she was like, oh no, let's talk about Lucille.
And thereby completing the massive accent swap that's going on in this film.
Oh, really?
Because half the British actors are playing Americans, and we have the American playing an English woman.
That's true. Oh my gosh. All right. So I'm going to say let's put up the spoiler wall now because I want to talk about the spoilers.
All right.
Okay. So if you don't want spoilers for Crimson Peak, now is the time you should stop because you should go watch the movie first. And now we're going to talk about all of the amazing stuff, like about how the monster of the movie is not the ghost, it's Lucille.
And Thomas a bit. We understand why and how he got turned into a monster, but he's not innocent.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of, well, obviously I have a lot of thoughts about Thomas. and in no way does that mean, you know, does that mean he's like this pure, sweet, precious Babu who is, you know, in any way, like, absolved of basically standing by while his sister murdered a lot of people, especially, you know, luring women to their death as the bait.
Right.
That is not a good thing to do. But I think what I actually found the most fascinating about this is, you know, I've got a very limited experience with the gothic genre for the literature, because frankly, I find the prose mostly impenetrable and not very fun to read. So my biggest experience with that is reading Jane Eyre, because of many of the novels, that's the one that I found the most readable. And kind of what I found interesting was after stepping back and looking at this movie, that Edith comes in, and yeah, she's a little like, she's kind of got that, I'm trapped in the house, I'm a little disoriented, there are ghosts, it's kind of creepy, but she's still like this very plucky heroine, and you never see her really get pulled into some kind of downward spiral. And really the character that's in the film that is actually torn between people and getting mentally screwed is actually Thomas, because he's basically getting his world turned upside down by Edith in a good way, compared to his sister, who he has a horrible, abusive, incestuous relationship with.
Yeah, he's the most damaged of the three, easily.
Yes.
So, I mean, that I found was kind of like this what I felt was like an interesting trope inversion. Plus, you know, at the end, instead of getting consumed by the house, Edith escapes and all of that, which I guess is what makes it a bit more romance and not a little less horror.
Well, and Edith,
it has a sort of happy ending, so happy for some and at least peaceful for Thomas.
Yes.
And Edith is a, I think she certainly fits into the, you know, perhaps with a in some ways stronger, but not out of keeping with the romantic heroine of the traditional Gothic. I mean, if you look at Anne Radcliffe's heroines, I mean, they faint a lot more than Edith does. But they, you know, quite often, like I'm thinking particularly of Emily in The Mysteries of Udolpho, when push comes to shove, she rescues herself in that book. And so she, you know, she's there's an honorable tradition with her right there. I think what there's a number of things I loved about Jessica Chastain's Lucille. One is that there we get an interesting inversion, that one of the rare instances where the Gothic hero villain is almost invariably male traditionally.
Yeah.
And here that's not the case, right? The apparent the candidate for the Gothic hero villain here turns out to be another victim. Well, victim slash monster in the case of Thomas. But Lucille is the full on monster. And the moment at the climax of the film, when you're brandishing a knife, she's screeching and flowing down the steps in that dress of hers. At that moment, I think that was the moment in the film that gave me the most chills, because everything clicked here. We needed a performance that was on the same scale as the sets. And Chastain delivers there, and you know she gives us what we need there: gigantic, all-consuming, shrieking villainy, with you know pulling out all the stops. And so she's suddenly a monster as monumental as the house at that moment. And I mean, really, we sort of have to look for her equivalent in Gothic literature. Probably to the Gothic's manifest id in the works of Saad, where she comes close to being a kind of Sadian superwoman. So everything about her and that climactic moment there, I loved.
What actually, like, I mean, because that was, yeah, that was over the top and amazing. And The thing, though, that I actually found the most chilling about Lucille as a character were kind of those quieter moments when she was being her most manipulative. Even when she was just, you know, talking to Edith and just being like, oh, it is a monstrous love and it makes monsters of us all. Like, her just presumption that she's pulling everyone in and it's like, oh, but we're all monsters. Or, the times when she's seeming to be very almost conciliatory towards Edith, being like, you know, oh, well, you don't have anywhere else to go. Or when what makes her so interesting to me as a character is how completely self-centered she is. Because every time somebody tries to make some kind of independent statement around her, she always steps in and is kind of like, no, you didn't do this. We did this. Or I did this.
Right, or and, what you did doesn't matter, or
yeah,
was inevitable.
The time that things don't go well, or she kind of loses her cool, like when she, you know, almost smacks Edith with a giant pan full of scrambled eggs. She's just basically it is that horrifying moment of look what you made me do.
Absolutely.
I was like, oh god, that is what made her like the greatest kind of monster to me, because she she is a almost realistic monster in those moments, because there are people like that.
And though it's, I mean, she's still, in terms of the, you know, the rarity of full-on female monsters that we get in film, I mean, she's still, has a strong sexual aspect to it. So, you know, we don't, you know, we're still looking for our you know, sort of Dark Lord equivalent. But given how much of the engine of the Gothic is sexual anyway, you know, whether it's subliminal in Radcliffe, pretty explicit in Matthew Lewis, or all over the place in Saad, it's very much, very appropriate. And so she was a terrific villain that made a lot of sense in the context of the genre thing that this film was being, while still inverting a lot of the tropes. So I think there's a lot that is just going, working so well with that character.
Right. I was going back to your speaking of the climactic moment where she's screeching on the staircase. There's that, and there's also I'll get back to that, but first I want to say, earlier in the movie I was getting kind of a Hound of the Baskervilles vibe between Edith and Thomas, in that I was thinking of them as the Stapletons in Hound of the Baskervilles, where Mr. Stapleton turns out to be an heir who's trying to get rid of Henry Baskerville, and his supposed sister, who is luring Mr. Baskerville, actually turns out to be Stapleton's wife. So I was thinking that kind of twist was going to come, but no, it's much more dark and disturbing than that. And then having that slowly evolve to the moment at the top of the stairs, which to me reminded me a little bit of the moment in Psycho, where the detective is investigating the house, and I can't think of his name.
Norman Bates.
Yes, Norman suddenly appears, you know, in the wig at the top of the stairs and pushes the guy down the hall, if I'm remembering it all. I mean, down the staircase.
Oh my, yeah.
that kind of, you know, there were just a lot of resonances in this movie, which I'm sure, it being Del Toro, were, a lot of them probably were there, and not just my imagination.
Yeah.
Well, see, I think you're alluding to the Hound of the Baskervilles is actually interesting, because Sir Arthur Conan Doyle does get mentioned earlier in the movie.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, because Alan's reading her, and there's part of me that wonders if maybe there's, like, you know, an orphan scene somewhere that got cut for time or whatever, but where, in that moment, Edith might have been going like, oh my god, it's the fucking Hound of the Baskerville! She's actually your wife!
Well, there is a moment where she says,
yeah,
you're
not a sister, and then Lucille's just like, no, I am. That's right. The best part.
And she just, doesn't she say, oh, you're so sweet, man, or something like that. You're so sweet, yeah. I
right,
am his sister.
Right.
It's just like, no, this is even more fucked up than you thought it was, Edith.
That's right.
Now I'm gonna push you down the stairs.
Oh,
fortunately, Edith is a very high impact individual, because she bounces back from that quite well.
Well, I was, you know, you said that Edith doesn't faint as much as, you know, the regular guy. I don't think Edith actually faints.
She gets knocked
ever.
Out several times, though.
Yeah, but
yeah, she gets knocked
out. But it takes
but it's
narcotics
never, like,
to do that.
Well,
yeah,
that's
it's
true.
Like she gets drugged, she gets thrown down the stairs, and that knocks her out, which is fair. I was expect, especially the way she hit that rail, I was expecting her back to be broken instead of just her leg.
And my goodness, that was a nice solid cast that the doctor put on her leg to let her go running around afterward like that.
I was just kind of like, this is my entire Edith is the most giant badass ever. Like, you know, no, it's not like she picks up a weapon and becomes an instant master. No, it's just she manages to run the fuck away from Lucille and then kill her with a shovel on a broken leg while she's half dead from being poisoned.
Right.
And I think that's something that, or I think Del Toro should have trusted his character a little bit more, in that having done all of that, he didn't need to give her the "I heard you the first time" line when, you know, after, you know, Lucille says, "You'll have to kill me to stop me," because it's this hasta la vista, baby moment that feels wildly out of keeping with the tone of the movie.
Yeah, it felt very inappropriate to me, which, okay, I'm glad I'm not alone on that.
I mean, it's been established what a badass Edith is. We don't need she doesn't need a tag at that moment.
I didn't find it jarring.
That's fair. We are allowed to disagree, because I am not Sean.
That's right.
and we're still friends. Okay, and I'm sorry, Trish, because I did kind of jump in there. Was there something else you were going to say?
Not about that, no.
Okay. Yeah, I just keep thinking about Lucille's amazing gown that's made out of, like, 7 gowns worth of fabric. Which is
there was great clothing, great costuming, great period details all through the movie.
And I think, I mean, you know, the color story in the movie is just fascinating, and I could get all wonky about that. Like, you know, Edith being dressed in yellow when she's not dressed in that insane nightgown of hers. My goodness.
Well, it did bother me a little bit that she was wearing yellow when I, from the how recent her father's death was, I felt like it wouldn't have been as pretty, but I kind of felt like she should have been wearing black or at least lavender.
That's true, because she should have probably been at least in half mourning.
She did have, like, black bands across the yellow dress, but I don't know. Maybe she didn't have time to buy mourning, and so she just had to sew some black material onto her regular dresses.
I mean, we did see her wearing black at the funeral, but the other thing I am kind of wondering, though, is if, you know, that would even be something people not familiar with the time period would really get.
And I wonder to what degree that, I mean, given how stylized the film is, right? I mean, obviously, realism is, especially once we leave the States, is the last thing on its mind. And I think, you know, where I guess to come, and I have to say, I'd missed that, the color coding that you mentioned, Rachel, but now you say that, that makes a lot of sense. And so I think the consideration for, sort of the realism of mourning would have interfered with the color coding. And
that's true. Edith brought light and warmth, into Thomas's life, and as well as sanity, let's say. and certainly having her wearing black along with, Lucille's dark, although lustrous clothes, she wouldn't have been as symbolic if she were forced into mourning all the time. Mourning clothes. Oh, and, I'm saying MOURNING, anyone who thinks I'm referring to English formal wear.
The colors, I mean, the color story is just, it's like gorgeous, and it's also, I don't want to say cartoonish, but it's very, very, it is very stylized, because, you know, let's talk about the crimson peak that the movie gets its name from. You know, that is not the color a red clay would be. But I need to have just a moment for my little geologist rant, where Thomas is talking about this clay and all of the ore in it, and it just drives me absolute batty, because the clay, if it is rich in a metal, could be treated as an ore, but what I think he's actually trying to say is that it's got a lot of iron in it, and that's why it's red. So, rant done. That was me just being like, you know nothing about geology, no wonder your mining business is failing.
Well, and I think, though, I guess slightly related to that is, at least for me, is something that I'm still, I kind of go back and forth on. And that's still with Crimson Peak, and that, I mean, I assumed that all the business with the clay probably, I mean, wasn't, terribly true to life, but without knowing so, as you would. But it's like, okay, I'm getting the whole, you know, it's blood and, you know, the whole symbolic thing. And as, you know, someone else, pointed out, it's interesting that they've got, you know, leaves are perpetually falling through the roof of the house when there are no trees anywhere nearby. I can work with that in terms of just the sort of atmosphere and symbolism. And it's all extremely formalist. And, you know, once we get to England, we've basically arrived in Neverland, right? So, or Wonderland.
Yeah.
So it's all, you know, all of those rules are going to go out the window. But I wound up having mixed feelings about the, production design, in that there were moments in the house, where Allerdale Hall started to veer uncomfortably close to, Hill House from the Jan Dubont remake, of The Haunting. where it was too screamingly haunted house. And I think this comes back to some of the issues I had with the ghosts, in that the it sounds perhaps a little self-contradictory, but I needed the house to be a little more grounded, so that it would really work for me. If you look at the I was thinking of the traditions that the movie is coming from. I mean, even though, it, like I said before, it's a particular form of the Gothic that I can't recall having seen before. But in the 50s and 60s, we have tons of Gothics coming out of Europe. And the English ones from Hammer and Imitators, the sets tended to be, well, the castles there tended to be castle sets. They weren't real castles. But a lot of the Gothic settings coming out of the Italian film industry used actual castles or actual locations. I mean, if you look at Mario Bava's Kill Baby Kill, which is an absolutely glorious nasty ghost story, which becomes completely surreal. And for that matter, what he does with another Gothic of his, Lisa and the Devil, you have actual locations that are shot in such a way that they become bizarre nightmares. And they feel unreal, and yet at the same time, you know that they are real. So there's a real heft to the setting. And some of, Allerdale Hall worked not too badly for me in that ways, and other times it was so over the top in its gothicness that again I started to get, you know, 1999 The Haunting or Disney's Haunted Mansion, I wasn't buying it anymore. And now the Gothic is not a subtle form. It's even when it's being restrained, it's over the top. But there's just some parts of the set design for me that were going so far over the top that I couldn't even pretend to buy into this house anymore. I was too conscious of looking at a film.
Mm. I mean, I think part of that is just that it's very much Del Toro's style. 'Cause if you look at a lot of his other films, particularly when he kind of goes into that darker and more fantastic element, like Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy, and then particularly the second Hellboy movie, which the story made no sense, but it was super pretty. But he's got this aesthetic where I think he always pushes it to the limit and then goes a little bit farther, to the point where you can't even necessarily follow him anymore. Because it stops looking even necessarily like film. It almost looks like something that you'd get out of a really fucked up picture book.
Well, and I think sometimes that works really well. I think some of it depends on the nature of the fantastic that he's dealing with. So in Pan's Labyrinth, there's that fairy tale quality, right? And I think interestingly, though, there, because he also grounds it so in such a committed way into the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War, that we have a sense of cost and weight of everything that's going around, and we move back and forth between these completely fantastical realms, and a very real, setting. And his monsters there are so, they're so explicit, but they fit and they work in that sense. His other ghost story, The Devil's Backbone, now there the setting does have that real quality to it, and he makes it surreal by having an unexploded bomb in the middle of this school. And so I think there in that film he has that very convincing setting that's still strange. Though his ghosts, I think ghosts are his weak point as far as his supernatural beings are concerned. Because there too, there's slightly too much of the wispy vapor rising from them. I mean, I love The Devil's Backbone. I think it's one of his best films. But the actual ghost manifestations in it aren't as good as the Fawn, and the other creatures in Pan's Labyrinth.
So it's almost like that maybe the problem in Crimson Peak really is like, you know, there was a reality in America, but there's no going back and forth between America and the unreality fairy, evil fairyland of England. It's just she goes to England and then she's there and it's fairyland all the way, which might be a little much.
Well, we get a couple of glances back to reality land with Alan. Thank you. Alan and the other people as he starts to put the pieces together with the investigation and into Lucille and Thomas. But they're fleeting, and then we go right back to unreality or hyper-reality or whatever it
yeah.
is.
Yeah. And I think it depends on the kind of unreality, because the Hellboy settings that you mentioned, Rachel, they work perfectly well in that context, I think. And if we look at the end of Pan's Labyrinth, when we get the other world, and it's much more over the top than anything at least as far as being completely unreal than we get in Crimson Peak. So I think it's where I'm having some hesitations is it feels like a slight, I don't know, maybe it, I mean, as much as Del Toro's love of the form is there, I don't know that this particular brand of the fantastic is his strength. The visualization of Allerdale Hall is pushing into the fairy tale rather than the gothic. Like, it's just going a little bit over that line. Between the two. And the fairy tale is something that Del Toro is a master of. And the ghost story, not quite. And so I guess there was a kind of a not quite feel, for me there. Not enough to, though I think the things about the movie that frustrated me all the more because of there's so many things in it that I loved so much. And so it this kind of almost but not quite, I guess, if that makes sense.
No, that totally makes sense, especially because it is a very unique movie in its place, you know, kind of within the genre. I wonder if that's also part of it, because it's taking a step beyond everything else that's been kind of done. I had a thought and then that was basically all that came out. Sorry.
Well, related to that, there were several things that frustrated or bothered me a bit when I was watching them. But then when I looked back at them, I realized that they weren't mistakes. They were clues. For instance, at the beginning, when Thomas Sharp, you know, looks at just a couple, you know, maybe has time to read a paragraph or so of Edith's novel, and says, "Oh, it's brilliant, it's wonderful," and
oh my god,
and I was like, "Oh, come on!" And I figured, well, I guess this is just film shorthand for that. But later, it turns out I'm firmly convinced that
he was totally
bullshitting
her.
Their plans were deep laid, and he had been stalking her and finding out stuff about her, and he knew who she was before he ever, you know, laid eyes on her in the office. So I think he was deliberately flattering her from the get-go.
Well, and can we just talk about for a moment how amazing it is that when her dad was like, "Here, I'll give you this money if you break her heart," you know, he has this amazing rant that's, of course, like, revealing of a lot of his inner self that probably was not intentional. But the way he finally, like, breaks her heart is by basically being like, you're a derivative writer.
That's awesome.
Right, and, that's absolutely, I hated how it happened when it happened, but I also kind of love that he went there.
Yeah, I mean, like, all it was missing was, "And your penmanship's terrible."
Well, you know, he was paid to break her heart, but he kind of pulverized it and stomped on the pieces.
You really did.
And I think that's a really good point, Rachel. I mean, like, when was the last time we saw a film where we've had other instances of the male character deliberately seeking to break the female character's heart? When was the last time that her heart was broken about her work and not?
Yes.
You know, what she looks like or her personality or something, right? It's, "You're a bad writer." That was the killing blow.
That's true. Well, what the other thing that I found so unique about this movie and I've just loved about it is I feel like it is actually a very, I mean, feminist is not the word that I want here, but it's a movie that's really told from a very female point of view and not just like a dude pretending, you know, oh, this is totally what females do. And what I find so stunning about this is that it was, you know, it was written by Del Toro.
Mm-hmm.
It was written by a guy. But then again, you know, I think he also wrote Pan's Labyrinth. So, I mean, you know, and that was beautiful from the perspective of a little girl. But, you know, it comes out in these little things like the fact that what breaks Edith's heart is insulting the thing that's most important to her, which is her writing and not, you know, her looks or her likability or things that, you know, like is cheap shorthand in Hollywood. And then the other thing that, you know, made me kind of go, this is a very, you know, the main character is a woman, the main villain is a woman, and it's got a very female perspective are things like, the only character that really gets sexualized, because I mean, you could kind of say that of Lucille, but it's all in a sort of really creepy, gross way, which, you know, nudity does not necessarily equal sexualization. All you have to do is look at Under the Skin. But the only character that really gets sexualized is Thomas in that scene with Edith when we, you know, we get the butt shot that launched 1,000 ships. And you know, and you think in this love scene where it's normally like, all right, let's show all the skin we can, which means the woman goes topless, da-da. The only person who really bears any skin for the whole time is Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's the object of desire in the film.
Exactly. Right. So it's written, you know, it doesn't feel like the male gaze really is intruding on the film, which, you know, is very surprising to me. And I mean, then again, like Del Toro, I've never come out of any of his movies being like, you know, oh God, let's put a woman in a bikini or whatever. I feel like Del Toro has always been extremely conscious about that. But this film just really stood out to me because, you know, the woman was not just an object of romance. It was a romance movie in which the woman was not the object.
Yes.
The man was the object.
Not the
prize. And I loved it. Exactly. And instead it was this male that these two women were fighting over, and not in the sort of way that you would necessarily get like in a regular movie where it's you know, oh haha, this guy is such a stud, he's got women fighting over him. No, it's a really terrible way.
They were fighting for control over his mind and his heart and I guess his soul. And that's not your usual romance trope.
Definitely yeah. Not.
And I think one of the things that's fun too is the way you have male characters in there who think they have agency, who think they're in a different movie than they are.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Like Alan. Oh my God, yes.
Yeah, he thinks he's in The Hound of the Baskervilles.
Mm-hmm.
He really does. And he's like, oh, I'm going to come in and I'm going to, you know, rescue Edith. And then Edith rescues him. I fucking love that.
and her father, who's the kind of, you know, patriarch as benevolent despot, who also, you know, all smugly, well, okay, I took care of that particular plot issue. And then gets his head smashed open on a sink. By the
evil woman.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And even earlier, right, when Edith, I mean, there's that other character, the mother of the woman that people initially think that Thomas has set his cap for.
Right.
And so Thomas brings Edith uninvited and knows that Edith is apologizing to the mother for showing up. It's not Thomas apologizing for bringing an uninvited guest. It's Edith mm-hmm. apologizing for having accepted and then being told, well, we'll find a place. Well, you know, we'll put you in your place. Or I forget exactly how she phrases it. But it's like, you know, Thomas's actions are completely irrelevant, right? He's just the trophy who's showing up. And all of the things that are actually going on are between the women.
Yes. And it's amazing to see because it's so unusual. So that alone just endeared this movie to me wholly. And I mean, you know, kind of like what looking at the struggle over Thomas between Edith and Lucille, I don't think it's necessarily a struggle for control because it's Lucille trying to maintain her control of him
mm-hmm.
and Edith actually just going, your story is not written, Thomas. you can make your own choices.
You're right.
Because basically, Thomas is a character in her story, and she's like, no, they talk to me. They go their own way. They do their own things. I don't know how it's going to end. So it's this, you know, this struggle over his soul with control, the controlling person on one side and the other person who's offering freedom, which is ultimately what kills him. him actually exercising free will and trying to stand up to Lucille.
Well, I guess we can't quite call her an unstoppable force because she was stopped eventually. But it would have been mighty tough for Thomas, as controlled and damaged as he was, to have successfully stood up to her. But he did get his freedom in the end, in a way.
Oh, yeah.
He's a pretty sad-looking ghost.
Well, hey, but he got to evaporate and fuck off, and he's not stuck with her for all eternity.
That's right. Oh, that would have been a horrible ending if they had left the manor and the two ghosts had been there locked in. Oh,
God. Darkest timeline.
That would have been terrible.
Oh, God. I would have just left the movie and just been like, I'm going to cry now. My God. No, but instead, Edith gets to rescue Alan and leave the house before, you know, because it ate its last occupants, but it didn't get her, which I love. All right, and we are at about, we just hit the hour mark, so, actually, it's less than an hour because I've been recording a lot longer than an hour. So we don't have to stop yet. I mean, is there anything else that anyone's got a burning need to want to talk about?
Well, I was talking about movie vibes before, and I just wanted to mention that I was getting a Notorious vibe from the tea.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, it's one of the Alfred Hitchcock movies, Ingrid Bergman is this kind of, her father was a spy, and she was a party girl, and then a guy from the CIA convinces her to go seduce a man for her country, and the communist spies find out what she's doing, and she's being slowly poisoned, and Carrie thinks that she just decided to go over to them. I mean, sorry, the CIA guy thinks she just decided to go over to them. Meanwhile, she's dying slowly.
Interesting.
Oh, and
from poison tea.
And I got mixed up for a moment there. I was thinking of, I think it's Suspicion, where, is it Cary Grant or Gregory Peck in that one? I think it's Cary Grant, right, who, actually fairly gothic. The question is...
Oh, that one, Suspicion, right.
Yeah.
That one was poisoned milk.
Yeah, or is it poisoned, right? Because that's the thing.
All right, or is it?
Yeah,
yes,
she doesn't know if... so it's Joan Fontaine and Cary Grant, and all very gothic, and is... Yeah, is he poisoning her or is he not? She doesn't know, and we get this creepy moment of him coming up the staircase with this milk that's glowing.
Jesus.
From the lighting.
Yeah, from the lighting, yeah. Yeah, it's not full of strontium 90, but yeah.
Still.
Yeah, so that, is he or isn't he a side of things.
And she looks at the milk after he goes, and finally she drinks it, and I don't, you know, it's not clear whether she's trying to make a statement that, yes, she believes in him, or she's so unhappy that she's drinking the milk because she's trying to poison herself.
Oh, my God.
It's a great movie. Great moment in that movie.
Oh, my goodness.
And I guess this sort of self-referentiality or the meta aspect that we get in the film is also, in a way, traditional to the Gothic. Certainly they had lots of this stuff in the Italian Gothics. I mean, one of the masterpieces of that form, after all, is the horrible Dr. Hitchcock. So if you've got a character called Hitchcock, as your antagonist, you're kind of signaling your intent. And, you know, they all are certainly movies which, prevent you from, you are reminded of the artificiality of what you're seeing. Baba's Lisa and the Devil certainly does this with the Devil is played by Telly Savalas sucking a lollipop shortly before he would do so in Kojak. It was almost providing a running commentary to about the bizarre events in the film. So That kind of those sorts of games that Del Toro's playing, I think is very much in keeping with the cinematic incarnation of the Gothic. If we wouldn't necessarily expect that in the literary form.
Mm. And I do want to just mention that since I went out and I made sure to go see this movie a second time because I liked it that much, there are some just amazing moments that when you watch it the second time, you catch and you're just like, oh dear. Like, when at the very beginning, when Edith tells that the horrible woman that she doesn't want to be Jane Austen, she wants to be Mary Shelley because she died a widow.
Yes.
I was like, oh God. And then the other just amazing moment, like, and in the middle of the theater, I uttered the most inappropriate laugh the world has ever heard, is when Lucille is standing there with Edith, and they're looking at the picture of Mother, which is already just like, you know, oh, she looks ghastly. And, but then Lucille says something like, I like to think that she's up there and can see everything that goes on here.
Oh.
And this is like, oh God.
Yeah, second time round, that gets really nasty.
Yeah, well, especially when Lucille's kind of like, oh, Mother found out about us, and you're like, oh, Jesus Christ. Oh God. She means her entire, oh, why? I need to go wash my hands in the middle of a movie. But yeah, I mean, there's beautiful, like, horrible moments like that. It's just, it's well worth watching more than once for that reason.
Oh, yeah, completely.
One of them also that you mentioned in your blog, Rachel, was where they're about to start dancing and Thomas tells Edith, you know, if you're uncomfortable, just close your eyes. And later we see the contrast in how he acts with the two women in his life, keeping his eyes open with Edith and closed with Lucille. I just, you know, Edith, after her first, you know, being a child, trying to turn away from her mother ghost. After that, she pretty much keeps her eyes open and confronts her fears.
Oh, that's true.
Very
bold.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think she kind of learned with her mom ghost. She was like, oh, they're going to come anyway.
Right.
Do you think mom ghost could have been a little more helpful?
Oh my God. Yeah, seriously, thanks, mom ghost. You gave her this warning that was absolutely useless until she got... And she'd already been there how long before Thomas was finally like, oh yeah, when it snows and they call it Crimson Peak. And she was like, what? the most vague warning possible in the scariest way imaginable. Way to go, mom. Good
so
job.
So helpful.
Yeah. Yes. Much help. Wow. Well, yeah, the ghosts, most of them were not exactly all that helpful except for Enola.
Right. Yes.
Cause Enola was the one that pointed her to where her husband had gone.
Yeah, there's something actually. The more I think about it, the more humorous Thomas's ghost is. The way he just kind of stands there and looks pathetic, right? He can't even muster being scary. He's just like, yeah, I'm just no good at anything.
Oh well, that is one of his greatest fears, though, because you know he's like, oh, I'm a failure, and Edith is the one who kind of picks him up. But yeah, no, he just stands there and looks sad, because that's basically what happened to poor Thomas.
Well, it is rather pathetic that you know he did finally get his machine working. He did, you know, just
it's
need some help to get it going. But it doesn't do them any good. It doesn't do any of them any good. It's sad.
It's a big red herring.
It's the MacGuffin.
Red clay herring.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Okay. I think we're done. All right. So, as is traditional, let us grade the film. And if you have any final thoughts, throw them in. David, would you like to go first?
Well, I've gone back and forth on this because there's still things that I'm debating in my mind, you know, did I like this or did I not? But it is a film that's definitely stuck with me, and certainly a lot of things that you two have been pointing out. It's like, oh, okay, yeah, no, I do like that aspect a lot. And it has made me run out and read Anne Radcliffe's The Romance of the Forest, which I hadn't read yet. So it sort of, you know, had me going on an original Gothic kick. So I'm going to give it a B+.
All right. Trish?
There's a lot that I love about this movie. There's a lot that didn't really quite work for me. And it's really not a movie for everyone. It's a select audience that's going to really appreciate this movie. So I think I will give it a B.
Fair enough. And for my part, I mean, I absolutely loved this movie. There were certain things that I was kind of like a little in about, so I would give it an A, but it's going to lose some points because there were some issues with the ghosts. But considering I loved this movie so much and dug into it so deeply that I spent an entire day writing a 3,600-word blog post about it, which is longer than some short stories I have written, I'm going to go ahead and give it an A-. It is, I think it's wonderful, and I think if you consider yourself to be a fan of the Gothic, you need to see it.
Yeah,
I agree.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that averages out to a B+, then.
That sounds about right. Hey, B+ is not a bad grade.
Perfectly respectable.
All right, so I think that's everything that we do, except, oh, we have to do the awkward ending, right?
Oh, well, we have to say how to find us, I think.
Well, I think...
Well, particularly you, Trish.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you get to say it, Trish, because this is your first time on the podcast. People know how to find me. I'm easy.
Okay. Well, I'm Trishium on some forums. I occasionally blog at whatsthewordnow.blogspot.com, and I'm fairly frequently on Twitter as @PEMATSON, @PEMATSON.
All right. And David, is there anything that you want to shill while you have the opportunity?
Of course, yeah, now I'm drawing a complete blank. Yeah. Just trying to think what okay, latest book out is, Sons of Titan. You can find all my latest stuff at theblacklibrary.com.
Does it have an angry yelling man with a gun on front?
He has a hammer, but he is angry and yelling.
Okay.
Yes.
Nice. And, I will go ahead and chill for Mothership Zeta, which the first issue of the magazine is now available, and I wrote a movie review that's in it about Turbo Kid, which is fantastic and full of squirting fake blood. So, thank you everyone for joining me, and awkward ending.
Bye.
Okay.
And see, you're welcome, citizens. You're welcome.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.